Hello and welcome to Influencers Cafe. Today on the show we have Brad Johnson and David Smith. Good evening, gentlemen, or good afternoon.
Hello, good to be here, Nico. Thanks for having us.
Whereabouts are you calling from?
So this is Brad. I'm calling in from Annapolis, Maryland today.
Dave, and I'm calling in from Newport, Rhode Island.
Cool, cool. So I see you guys, basically you're public speakers, leadership coaches, and you're very focused around the area of mentorship, which is very interesting to me because of my mentorscv.com. I'm just wondering if you could give us like your backgrounds leading up to your success or where you're at right now.
Yeah, sure, Nico. So I'll jump in, Dave, and jump in after me. So this is Brad, and I'm a professor at the Naval Academy and have spent most of my career researching mentoring relationships and what they look like when they're especially effective from the perspective of mentees, what great mentors do. So I've been writing about that for quite a while. And then my colleague Dave came along, and we really began to have great conversations about the gender piece in mentorship, and men, as you know, a bit reluctant to mentor women, and why that is such a problem in a lot of companies and organizations when men are not willing to lean in and engage with women, because women often don't get as much mentoring as men, and the quality's often not the same. So that's my background in a nutshell. But Dave?
Yeah, and my background, I've spent 30 years active duty in the Navy, a Navy pilot, and I spent the last 10 years of that or so in academia, about 8 of those with Brad at the Naval Academy, which is where we met. And I'm a sociologist, PhD there, and my background in terms of my academic and research interests has really been around the intersection of gender, work, and family. It's looking at gendered perspectives of work and family. And Brad and I found that we had this common interest, in particular around the access to resources and the inequities that we find, gender just being one of the many inequities around professional development and mentoring, sponsoring, the broader ideas of allyship as well. And so that in these conversations we had about how we noticed that in particular that that men aren't as easily to engage in this conversation about why they should be mentoring, again, in a more diverse set of networks out there, and being mentored by a more diverse set of mentors as well. And so we set out to do the research for that, and that led to our first book, Athena Rising, which was published in 2016.
I used to want to be a pilot. I was in the air cadets for several years.
Yeah.
What aircraft were you flying in the Navy?
I flew the P-3 Orion, which has been recently replaced by the P-8 Poseidon. So it's a multi-mission area platform originally used for anti-submarine warfare.
Is that a fast jet or propeller?
It's a multi-engine propeller.
So do you have any operations, maybe Desert Storm or anything like that?
Yeah, so I served from 1987 to 2017. So my first deployment was at the end of the Cold War. And my next deployment was in Desert Storm in 1991. And then follow on in many deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Gulf area.
How close were you to like Baghdad when they had all that anti-aircraft weapons and the like?
We were flying over it, but yeah.
Because you look at those videos, you see those tracers, there's these green dots. What, are they going that slow, or like, is that just normal projectiles, or is that rocket-powered things, or what?
Most of that you're seeing, that those tracers and things are you know, that's anti-aircraft rounds and things like that. But occasionally, you know, you would also see the plumes of from surface-to-air missiles as well.
Yeah. And so like that aircraft sounds like you could have quite a long career in that, because like it's not a strain that's stressful on your body like a fast jet. But I guess you're still launching in the catapult. which is a bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, I went to the end of as far as you can go in terms of flying as an aviator, you know, which is about somewhere in between about 18 and 20 years of flying. And after that, there's just not as much of the operational flying. You're moving into more of the senior leadership levels of the organization at that point.
Mm. Are you still, do you guys still participate in the, are you still ranked officers or are you civilians now?
Well, civilians. I've been retired for 3 years and I'm a civilian professor at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And Brad was prior, he was in the military, in the Medical Service Corps as a clinical psychologist on active duty in the Navy. Matter of fact, we overlapped for a little while. We didn't know each other, but we overlapped in Hawaii one of our periods of time there.
Yep. So what's the difference between a clinical psychologist and a psychologist? I should know this, but forget it.
Well, so Nikos, a clinical psychologist is trained primarily in, treatment of psychological disorders and distress and, you know, focus on behavioral health and helping people overcome difficulties they may have that are more clinical and mental health related. And that kind of separates us from psychology broadly.
Okay. Is there like quite a variation between like, I kind of forget the letters around the right way, PST or post-PTSD, between the Navy guys and the Army guys?
I don't think so. I mean, I think exposure to trauma is ubiquitous, and whether it's in combat or some other situation, I don't think the nature of the frequency of PTSD is probably much different across the branches.
So what is it that you both found so interesting about? Why do you see this gap for mentorship? I personally see a gap, but I'm just wondering what brought you guys to that point.
Yeah. So there are a number of things here, Nikos. I mean, number one, the data is very clear. You know, so when you ask men and women about their experiences with mentoring and research studies, you find that women get less frequent mentorship, they get less career mentorship, right? So men don't promote them in terms of their careers as much. They don't get sponsored in the same way that men do. So they don't get networked in. Men are a little less comfortable loudly talking about how great women are, you know, in the workplace and why they should get that next promotion and why people should want them to work, at their company. Sometimes men are worried about perceptions, they're worried about rumors, you know, how this will come across. If they're real fans and supporters of women, maybe especially junior women. Some men just don't know what to do either. You know, they're a bit anxious about how do I lean into this workplace relationship with a woman when I'm not even sure what that looks like and, you know, what that should be. And so when men are anxious, you know, we tend to avoid, we tend to step back and not engage. And there's also, you know, just the kind of implicit bias. So we tend to want to mentor and push forward people who remind us of ourselves, you know, and that can be gender, it can be race, it can be, you know, interests in career. We're tended drawn to people who look like us and remind us of ourselves. So men may not be seeing women as future leaders and as people who should be leading the company. So if they're not seeing women that way, they often don't lean into mentorship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about you, David?
Yeah, I think Brad hit most of the points there already, but I think a couple other things. One is that, lines as we mentioned earlier, you know, men don't see it as one of their normal the roles that they're expected to be in when it comes to the workplace. And I think this is one of these where, again, men might have a little bit of implicit bias that's working against them in terms of their perceptions of women, and that they maybe they're a risky investment of, you know, a flight risk, that they're going to be suddenly be leave, they're not committed to their jobs around these kind of stereotypical perceptions of women in that way, or that women just don't have the ability or the competence or the they're not tough enough to handle it in those ways. And so, again, if you hold those kinds of implicit biases, it's just naturally going to hold you back from investing in somebody fully, if you invest in them at all. And so we find that there's a lot of these reasons why men kind of avoid, or and sometimes it's not necessarily an intentional avoidance. It's just kind of a natural thing. They just don't see the demand or the need to do these kinds of things like they do for other men. And often I think the notion of what mentoring is lost on people, because sometimes if you ask men who have been doing mentoring, but they don't necessarily understand that that's what it is, right? The notion of how they're helping or pushing along a colleague, a junior colleague that they see themselves in maybe, or they see there's potential for them to rise up through the ranks in the organization. And they just see it as part of, you know, their relationship with this person, not necessarily because it's not in a formal mentoring relationship. And I think that formal piece also speaks to the fact that, again, most of us prefer an informal setting when it comes to mentoring, kind of the grassroots informal aspect of this. And so the more kind of authentic and natural it can be, the more we feel more comfortable we feel with that. And I think that's largely what we as men do.
Yeah, the word mentor's being abused quite a lot by social media people. I mean, people will go on and say, make videos like, I'm your mentor and all that stuff. Whereas you're basically paying for a course, and then he's suddenly your mentor. Like, I have a mentee. Like, how can someone say I have 1,000 mentees? In my social network, you can have up to 6, right? You can have this up to 6 at a time. You know?
Yeah, no, Nikos, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of our mantras when we're speaking to prospective mentors and doing a training is, unless you're paired in a formal program, don't call yourself somebody's mentor. You know, let them decide if you're a mentor, right? This should be something that they call you, not the other way around. And, you know, if I'm mentoring a woman or a person of color or some other group that tends to have less advantage in the workplace, and I call them my mentee, it can imply ownership or, you know, access or privilege in a way that I think could really land the wrong way with somebody like that. So I want to approach that relationship with some humility. I want to do the work of a mentor, and I'm not going to call myself one. And if that person calls me a mentor later, great, I'll feel great about that. But I'm not going to make any assumptions about how they see me.
Which is the whole point of my site, displaying the mentors and mentees. But it's very there, you know, because I want to try and promote it like as this thing. I think there's a lot of people sitting in retirement homes, like whereas they could be given they could be mentoring people. Those people, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old with skills that younger generations don't have. It's a valuable, valuable resource, you know, like. Think of the manufacturing skills, and you know, and I mean, people should be going to visit these people in retirement homes, you know. And I don't know how the verification process will look for personal security and all that stuff, but I just feel like we should be transferring skills. You know, I've learned so much from my personal mentor, legal and engineering, and just entrepreneurial stuff. Kind of gives you a lot of lot of encouragement,
right?
But I mean, mentorship, you can go on websites and you can get a mentor, but you have to pay for it. So for me personally, the mentorship is not something that you pay for. You know, okay, you can give back, you can give advice, or give, you know, for freebies, like, you know, but for me, it's like something that's voluntary, and that's what I'm trying to promote with my website, pro bono mentoring.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something with that, Nikos. I think that, you know, in my mind, when I think about paying for a service that's personal or career related, I think of, you know, in terms of personal guidance, I think of counselors who are paid for their work, and they should be. And when I think of professional guidance, I think of coaching, right? You pay a coach to help you with your leadership skills or interpersonal skills or whatever it may be. But that's different. It doesn't presume that this person is in your corner, that they're committed to you, that they're committed to the relationship, just beyond the transactional nature of the coaching or the counseling. And I think mentoring really presumes that there's an evolving trust and commitment on the part of both parties. And I think that's quite different than a fee-for-service kind of relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of communities, they're like gated communities, like you have to pay to get in them, and like that's, you get access to this relationship network. And I don't know, I think it's hard to put a financial value on relationships, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't actually know how I monetize this site at one point so that I can pay for the servers as it grows. And because, you know, like LinkedIn, you basically have a free profile and you can use it for free. So,
yeah.
Maybe you have some ideas that I haven't thought about yet. But I guess like Twitter as well, they had a free site for many years, but then they have like basically ads and sponsorships and stuff. But I would find it difficult to charge people for finding a mentor, you know, it's like.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are companies, Nikos, out there that will provide, you know, a mentoring platform in a company, but you're right, they're all fee for service, and some of them are more expensive. And, you know, the notion is that they're going to help people within a company find a match, you know, or something like that. I think the system that you're describing is really interesting because it's open, and, you know, people can access it even outside of their own company. And I think it provides a lot more access for folks than might be available in other kinds of you know, services where it's clearly an entrepreneurial you know, intent on the part of the company that provides the platform. I do applaud companies that have some structure to try and encourage mentoring, but you know, I'm not sure that just making you know, a random match is always very effective. So I like the idea that people maybe could get on your site and look at different potential mentors or mentees and then, you know, consider who might be a good fit.
But it also, I think, speaks to how we value mentoring and within an organization or as even as individuals. As you point out, Nikos, I think, right, if it's a pay to play, right, there's a certain value associated with that. But inside of an organization, often mentoring is taken for granted or as maybe as some sort of a implied expectation that, oh, well, that's just something that everybody does, that because you're in a particular position or of authority or responsibility or leadership, that's something that you do. But the fact is that it often doesn't happen unless that's just something that you naturally gravitate toward or you find value in. And again, I think good organizations that are really trying to foster more of think of it as kind of a mentoring culture, right? That this is who we are, it's part of who we are and what we do every day, find ways to provide value to the mentoring functions that and the people that are doing the mentoring and the people who are doing it really well. And you can usually see that, right? Because people, you can ask people in your organization, all right, so who should I go to if I'm looking for a mentor in this area? And people generally know the people that are doing this already and that they most appreciate the value in what they're doing. But we don't often assign any sort of any remuneration, right, for that, whether it's from pay or from time or from do we evaluate them or how good are they and what kind of resources do we provide in terms of training even so they can become even better, right? So if you have somebody who's just like the star rainmaker in your organization, wouldn't you want them to be mentoring all the high potential talent? But they don't clearly have time to do that because they have a day job probably, right? And so how do you find a way to, again, to kind of balance that for them, but again, continue to provide value because they're providing an incredible service for the organization.
I think the only way you can really get people to mentor people more is to give them a sense of it's almost morality, right? Because you're basically increasing the output of good for humanity from something that would take more effort to reach. So for example, when I was back as a junior developer, I remember one guy who was like my mentor. He had an almost infinite amount of patience, and he didn't tell me to do things. He would actually just take my computer and start coding on the stuff, and he would do it for me. And I would sit and stare at the code for like an hour, you know. But I learned so much. I learned at a rate like maybe 20 times faster at least when he was doing that, or even 100 times faster. So like, he basically saved the company money and saved me my time by upskilling me. So that's the approach that I use in mentorship. Is I'll just, as a coder mentor, I'll basically grab someone's laptop and do all the stuff on the laptop, and then just throw it at them and explain what it is. And you have to put that in. You have to put that initial effort in as a mentor. And sometimes, in fact, I probably say 90% of people would actually not benefit from it, but that 10% that does benefit from it is the ones that will just change their life.
Yeah. Yeah, I like your idea of the kind of higher purpose associated with mentoring, Nikos. When Dave and I were writing Athena Rising and doing all the interviews for Athena Rising, one of the things that was a key takeaway, and men needed to hear this, was, hey, mentoring women is not just about helping women. It's absolutely good for them, and we have the data to prove it. Their careers and their personal lives will be better for it. But guess what? Men also benefit. Men develop, you know, stronger interpersonal skills. Their networks get broader. They tend to enjoy all these terrific career-long friendships with women that they have mentored. And it's also much better for the organization. You know, so organizations make more money, the bottom line is stronger when you have more women moving into serious leadership positions. So it is a win for everybody. And if you take all those outcomes away, it's still the right thing to do. And I think that's what you're saying, Nikos. You know, there's kind of a moral obligation to pay it forward, right? And
exactly,
make life better. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what when I mentor people, I definitely tell them, please pay this forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see the bit Athena Rising, how and why men should mentor women.
And certainly we find that same mindset, that pay it forward mindset, in people who have received really excellent mentoring, and they saw the value in it and how it propelled them forward in ways that, and sometimes ways that they never thought possible for themselves, right? They're often, mentees will talk about how their mentor kind of helped them to see a future that they didn't even know existed for them, right? And it wasn't that they didn't have the capability to see it. You just don't have sometimes the breadth of experience. If you can kind of understand what your bottom line career goal is or your career dream is, then I can kind of help kind of begin to shape that and see the opportunities based on my own experience that's out there for you. So there is a lot of that. And that pay it forward notion, right, continues on. This is what develops that culture, because this obligation that I have to give back, because somebody gave to me in this way, right, of their time and their resources, and now I have to give back too to continue that on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you get to the end of your life and all you've done is accumulate money, then it's not going to feel as good as if you've helped a lot of people and helped their careers. You often see that people, stories on their deathbed, like, I feel like nobody loves me, you know, and that stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Nikos. We just finished a whole, I guess Dave and I have been working for the last 2 years collecting research for our most recent book, Good Guys, which is coming out here shortly. And one of the really interesting things was that, you know, women in academe who had really kind of made it and promoted and been really effective in certain disciplines, like I think it was engineering day, we had a lot of women in tech. If you trace it back, these women often had just a handful of male mentors in different universities around the country. And these male mentors were over years mentoring lots and lots of women, right? So it's what they did, it was their brand. And you know, at the end of their careers, they're responsible for this massive network of women who have made it and been very effective in their careers. And it's a remarkable sort of legacy. Really active mentors have this legacy. I think you're talking about, Nikos, that at the end of your life, you look back and kind of see the ripple effects of this mentoring. And it goes well beyond the people that you've mentored, as Dave was saying. Then that carries on to the next generation. And it has a remarkable impact.
Mm-hmm. So you're working on a new book right now, which is coming out in about a couple of months, right?
October 13th, yeah.
Want to tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so our first book, Athena Rising, came out in 2016. Brad and I were busy out there doing a lot of workshops and speaking around the topic of mentoring, and in particular, mentoring across difference with a focus on gender here. And as you might remember, 2017 was when Me Too really went widespread around the world. And we found ourselves being pulled more into conversations around not what men could be doing just around kind of mentoring and sponsoring, but more broadly about how can we show up in the workplace and make it more equitable broadly, no matter what level you're at, and not just around mentoring and sponsoring, but as allies. How can we really be active allies for women in the workplace? And of course, you know, the last few months, that's even broadened out further, especially around race today, that we're talking about it. But as we were, you know, as we were getting pulled more into these conversations and recognizing that there was a demand signal for guys in particular to understand how they could show up and be a part of making the workplace more equitable and rooting out bias and, you know, and confronting some of the challenges that are out there for women to make it a more equitable place to work, we realized the research, you know, needed to be done. And so that's what we set out to do. Brad mentioned the last couple of years, we pulled together all the latest social and behavioral science research, because again, our work is very evidence-based in terms of the actions that we recommend, but also the best practices that women talk to us about. And we interviewed senior women from across every industry and profession out there, and asked them, you know, how did men show up as allies in the workplace for them, and what was it specifically that they were doing or not doing in some cases to make it a better place to work and make them more successful, and what would they like those other men out there to know that maybe they didn't understand right now? Because a lot of men have told us that, yeah, you know, they're all for gender equality and all about, you know, making, leveling the playing field at work, but they're just not sure what their role is, or what is my responsibility, or how do I fit in, or what, you know, how do I do this? What can I do in it without making a mistake along the way? And so we also had a chance to interview senior men who were identified as male allies by these women that we interviewed, and talk to them about the work that they were doing. And it was interesting, you know, of course, it may not be surprising. There was a lot of humility with these men, much like we found with the male mentors for Athena Rising, that they just saw it as part of who they are, their brand, right? This is kind of their leadership brand. Others understood that it was a form of allyship. It kind of came down to two parts, the way they saw it. Really, the first part is they described it kind of the easy part about how they show up every day in their interpersonal relationships at work and advancing gender, being as fair and just around gender equity in the workplaces they can be, and holding themselves accountable for their own behavior, their own language, their own relationships, and how they collaborated with women at work. But they said the harder part was really the public piece. And this is around the public allyship of how do we not just show up there, but we actually, even when women aren't in the room, we still have to be an ally, and we still have to take the action required when we see bias or discrimination or some sort of form of an inequity. We have to call it out and then work to change that. And that gets to the systemic aspect of this, that there are everyday practices in our organizations out there where bias is created, say for pay, for example, the gender pay gap, that we can begin to address those. And where, whatever level of the organization we're in, there's different ways that we can do that. And that was what we did for our new book, Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace, was really to distill down in all these different areas of our everyday work and home, how we can be better allies and the specific actions and strategies and the tactical things that we can be doing each day to do that.
Yeah, personally, I don't understand gender pay gap for the same job. I mean, it doesn't seem right, right? I mean, what a women programmers that I have met, that actually been pretty good. One of the best I've ever met was a woman programmer.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's across industries. I don't think we're aware of a single industry, are we, Dave, where there's not a pay gap. I mean, it's just ubiquitous. One of the things that you'll see if you look at estimates on when we'll finally close the pay gap in the U.S. and other places, I don't know, it's at over 150 years, I think, if we just keep going at our current kind of slow progression toward gender equity. We have a long way to go. One of the missing ingredients, as Dave was referring to, is men entering the conversation and examining policies that keep pay gap and other things in play, challenging one another and their companies in terms of biases about women, policies they have that always penalize women, you know, when they step away, for example, to have a child, how we do hiring, how we do promotions, you name it. Men have got to be examining these things as leaders and as allies for women. Unless men are involved, because we guys are in control and we have the power often in most companies and industries, unless we guys are leaning in and getting thoughtful about this, we have a long way to go before we close the pay gap.
Are you seeing the pay gap for jobs at the same level, or are you seeing more a gap between the seniority of positions that women can reach?
Both. Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, it's both. Absolutely.
Both.
Yeah. The kind of an interesting one in particular is kind of the healthcare industry. And so women make up the majority of the healthcare industry across the professions, you know, the different occupations within healthcare. Women are the majority in like 2/3 of, I think, of the different occupations within the healthcare industry. Yet they don't. They're a minority when it comes to healthcare leadership. And the same thing goes for their pay. There's a pay gap there, even in healthcare, where they're a majority. When you would expect it, well, if women are a majority, there shouldn't be a pay gap there. But the problem is if women are not in the leadership positions, they're not in the places of power and influence, right, to affect these kinds of decisions, it's harder, and the pay gap can persist. And it's worse for women of color, right? So, and that goes again across industries and professions out there, that, you know, for Latinas or for Black women in particular, we find the pay gap is even worse.
So say we have a senior position X, right, and a man and a woman apply for it. Is it because the man has better negotiating skills that he's able to get this correct salary? Or is it because the woman is happier with less of a money, though she doesn't see her value? Or a mixture of both, I guess.
Yeah, it's everything you just said, Nikos. And Dave, jump in, because I know you do a lot of research on this. But, women can be socialized not to be as assertive in negotiating. And that's not true for all women, but sometimes that is true. Men get reinforced for being very, you know, active and pushing back and trying to negotiate. Men seem to get socialized into that earlier and get reinforced for it. The problem is that when you offer a job and do the interviews and that sort of thing, men seem to be okay with negotiating, you know, when they get the job offer. women are often not informed that that's okay, that they can negotiate. They sometimes get the message that they just better accept, you know, that first offer. And so, you know, Dave and I talk about this in terms of allyship, you know. So number one, you know, if you're offering a job and you want to close the gender pay gap, you better make it very clear that the salary is negotiable. You need to say that out loud so everybody understands that. And or you ought to be very clear that there's going to be just a salary band that's non-negotiable. And anyone who gets that job offer, that's the offer. So we're not negotiating. Whatever the policy is, make it very transparent and encourage everyone to kind of lean into the same, you know, either negotiate or not. But Dave, other thing, best practices?
Yeah, I was going to say that there could be some research that showed that women didn't negotiate as often, but today that's not true. Certainly over the last few, last few years or in the last decade, that's been brought out, right? That people understand now that women in particular, that they have to negotiate. The challenge with this is even when women do negotiate, they're still being not just offered less, but the resulting result of the negotiation is less. And one of the challenges with that in particular is when women negotiate, they begin to violate a lot of traditional or stereotypical expectations of how women should behave. And again, they become suddenly now they're being difficult or selfish. Whereas opposed for as a guy, you know, that's just me being brazen, and, you know, and aggressive and something confident and competent is the way guys get labeled when we do that. So even when she does negotiate, she takes a hit, both in her salary and maybe in the perception of who she is when she comes into the organization out there. Hey, Brad, I thought the Hideko story might be a good one here. You want to share that one?
Yeah. So we have a really wonderful, in our new book, Good Guys, one of the interviews we got to do, Nikos, was with Hideko Serra, who is a dean at a university in California. And she said that she and a male got hired at exactly the same time at their university. They published exactly the same. Their teaching evaluations were identical. I mean, they had precisely the same performance over a number of years. And then because of some restructuring, the president asked them to come in to renegotiate their salaries to a higher level. And the president wanted separate appointments with each of them. So her male colleague found out when Hideko's appointment was gonna be, scheduled his for the day before her, and then came directly to her office afterward and handed her a piece of paper and said, this is what the president just offered me. I want you to know this because I have a feeling that as a woman, you're going to get lowballed. You're going to get a lower offer. And that would be totally inappropriate. You and I have produced the same results. So don't you dare accept anything less than this number. And so sure enough, she goes,
job.
Yeah, but no, they both were keeping their jobs. They were just negotiating for a higher salary. And so she goes in, and sure enough, the president offers her $8,000 less than he had offered her male colleague. And she was able to say, hey, wait a minute, I know that you offered so-and-so this amount. And the president blinked and brought her salary right up. And so that was a great example of allyship. If you want to do something to close the ally or the pay gap, don't allow secrecy around salaries and benefits. You need to share this with your female colleagues.
So, like, so day to day now, what is your typical work with clients involved? Are you teaching women how to negotiate? Are you teaching companies to become more ethical?
So I would say that the vast majority of what Dave and I are doing right now, you know, with our books, Athena Rising and Good Guys, often what we're asked to do is come in and do workshops or do keynotes or do training around how men can become part of the solution when it comes to gender equity. And that could be more deliberate mentoring and sponsorship. But it can also be leaning in as an ally and understanding how to show up in the workplace in terms of relationships, in terms of your willingness not to be a bystander and disrupt sexism and harassment and biased language when you see it, and then how to rethink policies and be an advocate for policies that work for everybody in the workplace, you know, whether it's paid time off and telework and childcare accessibility. I think men who really want to be allies have got to be doing that public part of it. So Dave and I will work with companies around how to rethink policies and make them a bit more accessible and friendly across gender. But I would say the lion's share of what we're doing is helping men kind of up their skill level, up their game when it comes to better allyship with women in the workplace. Dave, other things that is on our menu?
Yeah. So I think, as Brad alluded to, there's a lot of the micro skills that we work on in particular with men. And part of that is really kind of getting to get them to understand and develop an awareness first. Because I think before, one of the challenges I think we all have is that I think as leaders, we all want to make sure our organizations are as effective and profitable as possible out there, right? And if there's a problem, you know, we're probably going to fix it. We tend to look at ourselves as being problem solvers, and we're going to work to address it and to fix it. But I think in many cases, men don't see this problem, right? The gender inequities that are in the workplace around how women are excluded or how they're not recruited or hired or promoted or given the same opportunities or the same resources as men. They just don't see that problem and how it exists. In some cases, it's also men, and we have some research around this as well, that shows that a misperception about what the problem is or how much they're contributing to the solution of the problem. So sometimes we just think that, gender pay gap is wrong, and I fully support that being, you know, corrected. But what am I actually doing? And largely around, we see the same conversation going on in our society today around race, right? It's not enough to just say that, well, I'm not a racist and I don't participate in those kinds of behaviors and language and do those things. Well, that's fine. But what are you doing to eliminate or fix the problem that's already out there? And so around gender in particular, you know, with guys, we asked them about that. And so it was interesting. There's some research Harvard Business School did a few years ago, and they went out and they asked executives across industries out there. They had about 800 of these people, and they asked them, so, you know, are you including women in all the important decisions you make regarding resources or in your company? And no surprise, 92% of the men said, yeah, absolutely, we are. Yeah, we're definitely including women in that. And then they asked the women executives and leaders there, and 82% of the women said, no, we feel like we're being excluded in one way or another in our organization. So there's a misperception here. And we see the same thing when you ask it in other ways. Are men listening? Are they developing an awareness? Are they participating in things in the same way that women think they are? And there's a gap there. We call this the allyship gap, this difference between what we think we believe or we're doing and what we're really doing out there in accordance with what women say in particular. And so we work to develop an awareness and how we can begin working on the micro skills in particular to do that. And that requires a certain amount of curiosity and motivation to learn, having a learning orientation. You're going to have to interact with women in your organization to begin to understand that. And that in and of itself can be a challenge, because in many cases, men aren't as often friends with a lot of the women in their organization. And they're probably not mentoring as many women in their organization, and certainly not mentored by women. So how do we begin to develop and create these interactions? And especially in kind of this post Me Too workplace, where there's already, again, kind of this fear in many cases of men not wanting to engage because there's this fear that something, you know, untoward is going to happen.
Yeah, this is fascinating content, guys. How much of the blame do you think this whole Me Too thing and whatever problems workplace for men and women has to do with like the media and Hollywood from like the 60s onwards, from the, you know, the sexual revolution?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Nikos. I mean, you know, when Dave and I were kind of dealing with the aftermath of Me Too and the work that we do, One of the things that we noticed, you know, there was research coming out after Me Too from Bloomberg and Lean In and other organizations showing that something like 60% of men in corporate America were less comfortable having any contact with women at work, right? Like lunch, coffee, conversations. Men were avoiding all of that. And when you really listen to what men were saying after Me Too, it had a lot to do with false narratives about what Me Too was actually about, right? So men were blaming women for Me Too and forgetting that Me Too was actually caused by some male predators and serial harassers. Men were suddenly, you know, coming out with a narrative that women are dangerous, right, in the workplace. They make lots of false accusations. Dave and I have looked at the data. There's not a shred of evidence for that. Women don't, in any measurable numbers, make false accusations against men. So we had to push back on that and say, dudes, really, Me Too is really simple. It's about women asking not to be assaulted or harassed in the workplace. It's a really low bar for men to get over. And the only way to manage that anxiety, I think, is to have more exposure deliberately, right? Have more interaction with women at work, initiate more mentoring conversations, and take more junior women to coffee. And I guarantee you, your anxiety will decline if you're anxious. But you mentioned, you know, the 60s, Nikos, and I, you know, it's interesting because I do think there was a narrative, you know, that we all maybe were exposed to from an earlier generation that, you know, men should not be in the presence of women who aren't their partners or wives, right? There's something dangerous about that, or it's not okay. I think in the modern day workplace that, you know, if the aspiration is to make that very gender balanced, that old narrative is not productive and it's not helpful. And I think it communicates, again, it reinforces messages that women are dangerous or, you know, unreliable. I think what men often don't realize is that it also says something about you as a man. If you're not willing to have a closed door meeting with a woman, you know, what does it say about you? Because it probably says that you don't trust yourself either.
Sorry, I missed you the last 5 seconds there.
Doesn't communicate anything very. I think if men are not willing, Dave and I, when we're speaking, will sometimes have men say, "I would never have a closed door meeting with a woman, right? I just wouldn't do that." And I think that when you do that, you're communicating that women are dangerous, or that you can't trust yourself to be appropriate, you know. And I don't think that's what any of us should be communicating. So I guess if you're a guy who's still too anxious to have a closed door meeting with a woman, then don't you dare have closed door meetings with men, right? Because it's not fair. And it communicates that women are dangerous and men aren't. And we can't do that as leaders. We've got to level the playing field, especially around our mentoring and our development of others.
Yeah, also, I think quite a lot, for me personally, I think that the way that a lot of Hollywood, you know, promotes women as objects, for me, I really don't like that. I think that they have to take responsibility as well. Personally, when I'm at work and you hear locker room talk and all this stuff in the office, that should be, I mean, he can't like, go grasp about it, but people should be able to say, no, you can't say that about that girl there. You know, it's not right. You know, we as guys should not allow this kind of talk and treating women as objects. It's shocking.
Yeah, and it takes that kind of, we talk about it as kind of a disruption of the status quo, right? Because it's been part of the status quo for far too long, this locker room talk. And there's, you know, even in the research, the social psychological research shows that we think as guys, when we're all together, you know, in a group, that there's this high level of acceptance of sexism or sexist comments and language and behavior. And the reality is that we don't. Most of us don't accept it, and most of us don't want to tolerate it, and it does offend us in some way. And it only takes one of us, right, to intervene, to speak up, and then suddenly everybody's like, oh, you mean you don't agree with it either? And then next thing you know, right, then the majority comes out very quickly against it. But the problem is, far too often, if a guy does speak up, They often will say, oh, you know, and especially if there's a woman in the room, they'll say, oh, you can't say that around because Mary's here in the room. And so they kind of shift it off onto her and don't own it themselves. Like, no, you can't say that because it offends me and it's not okay with me, or it's not who we are in our organization. And we have to take ownership of that.
I mean, if my opinion of a guy is here, as soon as it comes up to the locker room talk, my estimation of him has dropped way down there. You know,
yeah.
To any guy, I don't care. I don't care how successful they are. If you talk about a woman, get lost.
Well, yeah, and I think honestly, for good reason, Nikos, women feel exactly the same way. So if you're one of those dudes who shows up and tries to be, quote, nice to women that you interact with and come off as an ally, and then she hears you engaging in this locker room banter or hears about some joke you told among a group of men, you've just totally undermined your brand as an ally, and you've shown that you're not congruent and that you're not reliable as an ally in the workplace. So I think men sabotage themselves quite a bit with that kind of double standard.
Yeah, it's great stuff, guys. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. So anything else you want to share with the audience before we finish part one, as we say?
Yeah. Well, so if you're interested in this conversation around allyship and how men can be better and really lean in, then our book, Good Guys, comes out October 13th, and it should be a fun read to see what a lot of women and men told us about their experiences of allyship.
Great.
Yeah, and it's available for pre-order today. Athena Rising, the mentoring part of this is obviously available right now. And if you're more interested about, Brad and I write pretty routinely for Harvard Business Review, so you can always find us there in terms of our writing on these particular topics, and certainly our websites. Brad's at wbradjohnson.com, and I'm at davidgsmithphd.com.
Great. Well, it was an honor to talk to you guys, and stay in touch.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nikos.
Thanks a lot, Nikos. Thanks for inviting us.
Enjoyed it.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. Well, thank you, my audience. That was David and Brad, and fascinating gentlemen. Go find them on the websites, and we'll see you again next time on Influencers Cafe. Bye-bye.